Not 21 yet,
I told her.
Next month,
she whined. I smirked at her.
You bet on my wedding. You don't get any favors.
I straightened up. I had a sudden, delightful idea.
Wolves,
I said, and reinforced my call with a touch on the pack bonds I was only just getting the hang of. I didn't have to speak loud, either. All over the church, the wolves, all wearing their human faces, perked up and turned toward me.
My sister Ruthie isn't 21 yet. No alcohol for her.
Then, in case she didn't get it, I told her, "You go anywhere near that punch or any other alcohol today, my wolves are going to interfere." Ruthie stamped her foot and looked at Nan.
"You just wait. You bet, too. She'll get back at you, and I'm going to be the one smirking."
She stalked off with an offended air while Nan and I watched. Nan shook her head.
"Some poor man is going to end up with her."
I laughed. "He'll never know what he's gotten himself into. Kurt still thinks our mother is a sweet thing who needs his protection, and he's perfectly happy about it." I remembered belatedly that I was supposed to be mad at her. I frowned.
"Enough about Mom and Ruthie. You were going to tell me how you went from bet to surprise wedding."
"Well," she said, "like I said, it is your fault. When she saw how stressed you were getting about it, Mom offered to do the whole thing for you." She laughed at the look on my face.
"I know, terrifying thought, isn't it? But you obviously weren't going to enjoy planning it yourself, either."
She slanted a thoughtful look at Bran, who was talking animatedly with my stepfather. My stepfather was a dentist. Bran ruled werewolves. I didn't want to know what they had in common to get that excited about.
"So anyway, we started egging you on," Nan said, "just for fun, and the betting got just a little more serious. As soon as the money at stake got over $20, Mom's competitive instincts overruled her motherly ones. The date Mom picked for your elopement was tomorrow, so she planned the butterfly and pigeon thing, but I guess about then she started feeling bad about robbing you of a real wedding. She decided to plan the wedding without you anyway, which proves she must have a conscience, if a little underdeveloped. She enlisted Jessie as her woman on the ground and got this wedding together with her usual efficiency."
Nan took a big swallow of alcoholic punch, and her eyes watered.
"I am so glad Todd and I eloped," she said sincerely. "There was no way to salvage the wreckage, but I think that you deserved this, and I'm very happy for you."
She leaned forward and kissed my cheek. Then she whispered,
"He is really, really a hottie. How did you manage that?"
"Brat," I told her and gave her a hug. "Todd's not exactly chopped liver." She smiled smugly and took another sip.
"No, he's not."
"He could be," said Ben from behind me, his British accent giving him a civilized air that he didn't deserve. "Do you want him to be chopped liver, darling?"
I turned, making sure I was between Ben and Nan. "My sisters are off limits," I reminded him. A flash of hurt came and went on his face. With Ben, it was even odds whether the emotion was genuine or not. But my instincts told me it had been, so I continued in a mock chiding tone. "Ruthie is too young for you, and Nan is married to a very nice man, so be good." Nan had caught the flash of hurt, too, I thought. She was softer than our mother, more like her father in temperament as well as looks. She couldn't stand to have anyone hurting and not do anything about it. She sighed dramatically.
"All the pretty men, and I'm tied to just one."
Ben smiled at her.
"Any time you want to change that."
I poked him in the side. He could have slipped out of the way, but he didn't bother.
"Okay," he said, backing away with exaggerated fear. "I'll be good, I promise. Just don't hurt me again."
He was loud enough that all the people around us looked at us. Adam pushed his way through the pack and ruffled Ben's hair as he went by him.
"Behave, Ben."
The Ben I'd first met would have snarled and pulled away from the affectionate scold. This one grinned at me and said,
"Not if I can help it, I won't,"
to Adam. I liked Ben. But if I catch him alone in a room with Ruthie or Jessie, I will shoot him without hesitation. He's better than he was when he first came to Adam's pack, but he's not safe. Some part of him still hates women, still looks upon us as prey. As long as that is true, he needs watching.
"I have someone I'd like you to meet," Adam told me with a nod to Nan. He took my hand and led me past the giant wedding cake. It was a beautiful thing of blue and white flowers and silver bells, and despite having been cut and served to everyone here, it was still huge. Someone else had ordered it for another wedding and hadn't paid for it, which was the only way, Jesse had told me, that she'd managed the cake. Whoever had originally ordered it must have been planning a much bigger wedding than this one. I glanced at the crowded basement and tried to imagine a bigger wedding.
"Quick now," Adam told me and tugged me out the side door and up the back stairs. "We're escaping."
We made it out to the parking lot without seeing anyone else. Adam's truck, inexplicably attached to a huge gooseneck travel trailer that looked bigger than the mobile home I'd lived in until this winter when the Fairy Queen burned it to the ground, awaited us, poised for a quick getaway. "What's a hurry?" I asked as Adam boosted me in through the driver's side, got in behind me, and started the truck before he had the door closed.
"Some of the Fae have an odd idea of bride send-offs," he explained, as I wiggled over to the passenger seat, and he guided the truck out of the parking lot. "Including, according to Z, kidnapping. We decided not to chance Bran's feelings should such a thing happen, and Z promised to run interference for us until we were off."
I forgot about that, and I was appalled because I knew better. "Bran and Samuel are probably more of a danger than any of the Fae," I told him. "Someday I'll tell you about some of the more spectacular wedding antics Samuel's told me about." Some of them made kidnapping look mild. I belted in, helped him to put on his own seatbelt, and glanced behind us again. "In case you didn't notice, there's something very big stuck to the back of your truck." He smiled at me, his eyes as clear and happy as I'd ever seen them.
"And that's my surprise. I told you I'd plan the honeymoon."
I blinked at the trailer. "Bring your own motel room along?" It loomed over us, taller than the truck, which was plenty tall on its own, taller and wider, too, with sections along the sides that were obviously intended to pop out. "I'm pretty sure it's bigger than my old trailer." Adam glanced over his shoulder and huffed a laugh.
"I think it might be. This is the first I've seen of it. Peter and Honey took the truck and hitched it up."
"Is it yours?"
"No, I borrowed it."
"I hope we're not going anywhere with little windy roads," I said, "or small parking lots."
"I thought we'd spend the night in this really neat truck stop I know of in Boardman, Oregon," Adam said, guiding it onto Highway 395 southbound. "The smell of diesel and the hum of big engines to accompany our first night together as man and wife."
He laughed at my expression.
"Just trust me."
We did stop in Boardman to change out of our wedding-required clothes. Inside, the trailer was even more amazing than outside. Adam unhooked the billion bitty buttons that ran from my hips to my neck. A billion bitty buttons from my elbows to my wrist still awaited the required two hands to unbutton, so all I could do was look around the trailer with awe. "It's like a giant bag of holding, huge on the outside, but even bigger on the inside."
"Your dress?"
he said, sounding intrigued. I snorted. "Very funny. The trailer. You know about bags of holding, right? The nifty magic items that can hold more things than would ever really fit in bags of their size?"
"Really?"
I sighed. "The make-believe magic item from Dungeons and Dragons." I craned my neck around and said, "Don't tell me you haven't played D&D. Is there some rule that werewolves can't indulge?" He leaned his forehead against my shoulder and laughed.
"I may have been born in the Dark Ages."
Actually, he'd been born in the 50s, though he looked like he was only in his mid-20s. Being a werewolf halts and reverses the aging process.
"But I have played D&D. I can tell you for certain that Daryl has never indulged, though. Paintball is his game."
I took a minute to picture Daryl playing paintball. "Scary," I muttered.
"You have no idea."
Adam rubbed his cheek against mine and went back to his task.
"I could just pull this apart instead of unbuttoning it," he said 10 minutes later.
It was a serious offer, spoken in a hopeful but doomed voice. "You do, and you get to sew all the buttons back on," I told him. "Jesse is planning on reusing this."
"Soon?"
he asked. "Not that I know of."
"Somehow," he grumped, "that's not as reassuring as it ought to be."
"Gabriel's going to college in Seattle in the fall," I reminded him. "I think you're safe this year." My right-hand man had a thing for Adam's daughter, and right now he was living in the tiny manufactured home that the insurance had replaced my old trailer with, a situation that made them happy and Adam antsy. He liked Gabriel, but Adam was an alpha werewolf, which put him off the scale protective of his daughter. Eventually, Adam managed the buttons. While I hung the dress up and put it in the closet, yes, there was a closet, Adam stripped off his tux and pulled on jeans and a t-shirt. He didn't often dress down that far. Except for when he was working out, usually slacks and a button-up shirt was as grubby as he got. My clean shirt and jeans were dressed up for me. I was a mechanic by trade, and it was a rare thing when my fingernails were clean. Somehow, we fit together anyway. He bought us milkshakes and burgers, one for me, four for him, from the nearby restaurant, filled the diesel tanks in his truck, and we were back on the road. "Are we going to Portland?" I asked. "Or Multnomah Falls?" He smiled at me.
"Go to sleep."
I waited 3 seconds. "Are we there yet?" His smile widened, and the last of the usual tension melted from his face. For a smile like that, I'd do anything.
"What?" he said.
I leaned over and rested my cheek against his arm. "I love you," I told him.
"Yes," he agreed smugly. "You do."
The Columbia Gorge is a canyon that runs nearly 80 miles through the Cascade Mountains with the Columbia River cutting through the bottom. It is part of the border between Washington and Oregon. Most of the travel is on the main divided highway on the Oregon side, but there is a highway on the Washington side that runs most of the length of the gorge. Though the western part of the gorge is a temperate rainforest, the eastern section is dry steppe country with cheatgrass, sagebrush, and breathtaking basalt cliffs that sometimes form columnar joints. Adam turned off the highway at Biggs and took the bridge back over the Columbia to the Washington side. That bridge is one of my all-time favorites. The river is wide, a mile or nearly so, and the bridge arches gracefully up and over the water to the town of Maryhill. It was founded by financier Sam Hill, as in, where in Sam Hill, in the early 20th century. He'd envisioned a Quaker paradisaical farm community and named the town after his wife, Mary Hill. She might have thought it was cooler, I suspect, if it weren't out in the middle of the desert with about 2 inches of soil. There isn't much left of the town, a few small orchards, a couple of nearby vineyards, and a state-run campground, none of which made Mary Hill special. But Sam Hill hadn't stopped with the town. He built the very first World War I memorial, a full-sized replica of Stonehenge visible from the highway on the Oregon side of the river. We turned west once we were over the bridge, though, away from Stonehenge and Maryhill. After 10 or 15 minutes of driving down a narrow highway that cut its way along the desert steppe country of the Columbia Gorge, we came to a campground. Though it was groomed to within an inch of its life, there was no one inside. Adam pulled in the driveway, took a card off the map holder on his sunshade, and swiped it through the control box next to the gate. A green light flashed, and the gate slid open.
"We have it to ourselves," he said. "I did some of the security here, and they told me we could stay, even though it doesn't officially open until next spring. I'm sure the shower in the trailer works, but the ones in the restrooms over there are a lot bigger."
I looked around the campground, where tall oaks and maples gave shade to the graveled RV spaces. The big trees weren't natural for this part of the state, any more than the green, green grass. Someone had spent a lot of time tending them. Adam pulled into a spot halfway between the gray stone restroom and the river. I found myself frowning at one of the trees. It must have been 60 feet tall, its roots buried deep in the earth, where it wouldn't disturb the groomed campground. 10 days, I said. He knew how my mind worked.
"Z has the shop," he said. "Daryl and his mate are watching Jessie, who told me before we left that she didn't need a babysitter."
"To which you answered that they were bodyguards, not babysitters," I said. "But she argued that bodyguards usually didn't get to tell the people they are guarding what time they have to be home."
"And you weren't even there for the argument," marveled Adam. "Daryl broke in and said, 'Family does.' And that was the end of that. So what else are you worried about?"
"Stefan," I said. I asked Warren to look in on him, but...
I had a talk with Stefan, said Adam. Unlike you, my conscience didn't prevent me from telling him he needed to fill out his menagerie. One of his problems is that he doesn't want to hunt in his backyard, and he can't leave his menagerie alone. Ben offered to watch his people, and Warren should leave for Portland tomorrow with Stefan. Anything else?
10 days, I said, giving him a broad smile. 10 days of vacation with you. No interruptions. Adam leaned over and kissed me. And that was the last time I worried about anything. For some time.
Chapter 3. We swam in the river. Or rather, I swam and Adam waded in chest high because werewolves can't swim. Their muscle mass is too dense to be buoyant, so they sink to the bottom, like anchors. The campground was built around a fair-sized backwater that was fast enough not to be stagnant, but slow enough to be really good swimming. Strategic growths of Russian olive and a selection of shrub-sized plant life I couldn't name, as well as a 10 or 15 foot drop just before the river, gave the swimming area a feeling of privacy. The temperature had risen to somewhere around 100 degrees Fahrenheit, so the water felt really good. We splashed and dunked each other like a pair of kids, and I laughed until I had to go out and sit on the shore to catch my breath.
Coward, Adam said from the river, his hands just below the surface where he could gather ammunition to splash me.
Not a coward, I vowed, panting as the sun tried to bake the water out of my hair, skin, and swimming suit all at once.
Then what are you doing up there? He asked.
I opened my eyes wide and batted them at him. Watching the wildlife. I lowered my gaze to his midsection where all sorts of lovely muscles were displaying themselves. Werewolves are seldom out of shape, but Adam was a little more ripped even than the average werewolf. Some nice scenery around here, I purred. He made a soft sound, and when I raised my gaze, his eyes were hot.
I have to agree, he said, stalking out of the water with purpose.
I squealed and came to my feet laughing, and something out in the water beyond him caught my eye. He spun around to see what I'd noticed, but it was gone. A log, maybe, I thought, floating a little below the surface. Hard to judge the size at this distance, but it had been too big for a fish. Before the dams went in, some of the sturgeon got pretty darn big, upward of 12 feet if I believed Z. Whatever I'd seen had been bigger than that. But it was gone now, and I'd distracted Adam from his hunt. He was looking behind him. I took advantage of his momentary distraction and bolted toward the trailer. Werewolves are quick. Not cheetah fast, maybe, but faster than timber wolves or dogs. I, too, am very fast. Faster than most werewolves I know, so maybe I wasn't running as hard as I could. Or maybe sex inspires the male of any species to greater lengths. Either way, Adam caught me before I was halfway to the trailer. Without slowing down, he tossed me over his shoulder and ran all the way back while I laughed like a ninny and tried really hard to breathe. He pressed me against the side of the trailer and made sure I didn't mind my capture at all. Somewhere along the way, we made it into the trailer and up on the soft queen bed that was made with clean new sheets. In fact, the whole trailer smelled brand new. Trailers like this were expensive. Who did he know who would loan him a brand new trailer? That thought left me too. And when we were finished, I was as hot and sweaty as I'd been before I first jumped into the river. The trailer smelled like us, and Adam was asleep. Mating is a lot more permanent than marriage. Partly, I think, it's that usually if you find your mate, he's not going to be someone you need to divorce. Abuse is almost not possible when two people are connected by a mating bond, and it gives you insight into your mate that allows you to avoid the nastier fights that snowball into cold distance. And partly, it is that magic is somewhat harder to deal with than legal paperwork, and the mating bond is pack magic. Given that, I hadn't really expected for the actual wedding to matter so much to me.
I like having you wear my ring, said Adam,
his eyes yellow and gleaming out from under half-open lids. Sometimes the mate bond gives more insight to one or the other of us. He seemed to be responding to the gist of what I'd been thinking while I was being kept in the dark.
I like that people can just look at you and know that you are taken, that you are mine.
He closed his eyes and laughed.
And yes, I know that sentiment is at the top of the women's liberation movement's list of things not to say to a modern woman.
Something was bothering him, I thought. The last sentence or two had been just a little too tight.
I said, rolling over so I could lick a bead of sweat off his chest.
He tasted like Adam, who needed champagne.
You'd better not take off your ring without a really good reason, I told him, letting my inner coyote out where he could see her.
Maybe he needed to know his possessiveness was returned, in spades.
And if your ex-wife or any moderately attractive woman from 13 to 70 is in the area, you should be aware that there is no reason good enough for you to take off your ring.
He laughed, and I rolled again until I was all the way on top of him. I hadn't gotten it right yet, hadn't worked out what was bothering him. Our bond might be talking to him, but it wasn't letting me know anything that was going on behind his eyes, which had gone dark again. That's the problem with magic. You start counting on it, and it disappears out from under your feet and leaves you floundering worse than if you'd never had it in the first place. So all I could go on was what most other women had to use to interpret their mate's moods. I had known Adam for more than 10 years. I'd known his ex-wife Christy, too. Maybe his problem was rooted in his first marriage. She'd been big on personal freedom, as long as it was her freedom. She'd been jealous of the pack. Jealous also, I thought, of Jessie, their daughter. She didn't love him, but she had wanted to be the center of his world and would tolerate nothing else. Maybe he felt that he was trying to do that to me. Maybe we both needed to lighten up the atmosphere a bit, give ourselves time to deal with all the changes. I nipped his ear lightly. If it were socially acceptable to tattoo my name across your forehead, I'd do it.
I only see my forehead when I look in a mirror, he said. I see my hand a lot more often.
It wouldn't be for you, I told him. You know who you belong to. It's for all the other women. Only fair to warn them when the wrong word might get them hurt. This coyote has fangs. His chest vibrated under me, the laugh not making it all the way out yet. He relaxed subtly. I thought that if you're feeling primitive about this, it is only fair to let you know that I'm feeling pretty primitive, too, I informed him lightly. Then I rolled off him and over the edge of the bed to drop down on the floor. I kicked my swimming suit, now cold and clammy, aside. However, you ought to know that I can't work at the shop with my rings on unless I want to be known as Nine-Fingered Mercy, and, I put my fingers on the paw print just beneath my navel, having gotten all the tattoos I ever intend to, I won't tattoo your name on my forehead or anything like that. He jumped out of bed and strode to his suitcase. He unzipped the outer pocket and pulled out a flat box, which he handed to me. I opened it to find a thick gold chain with a battered military dog tag on it. Hauptmann, it read. Adam Alexander. The last time I'd seen it, it had been one of a pair on the same steel chain lying on Adam's chest of drawers.
That's to put your rings on when you're at work, he said, taking the chain from me and putting it around my neck.
As he fastened the chain, he kissed the back of my neck. He stayed there for a moment, his fingers tight on the necklace. He'd given me one of his dog tags. I was never a soldier, but I'm a historian. I know why they started using a pair of dog tags. When a man died and his buddies couldn't get the body out, they'd leave one tag with the body so anyone who found it could identify him. The other would be used to report his death. That dog tag meant more to him than the ring did. And so it meant more to me, too. I noticed that the chain looked to be tough enough that I could wear it when running as a coyote, too.
I need to go for a run, he told me, taking a full step back and slapping me lightly on my naked rump.
His fingers lingered a little, testing the faint buckshot scars left from when I'd gotten a bit too close to a gun-happy rancher.
You want to come with?
Long run or short run, I asked warily. Wolves love to run, but even most of them don't love to run the way Adam does. He pulled on underwear and running shorts, socks and shoes as he considered my question. Long run, he said, sounding a little surprised. I'm a little wound up about something.
He let his voice trail off and gave me a small, almost shy grin.
Wolf instincts are good, but sometimes it's hard to figure out what's touching them off. Running helps connect the frontal lobe with the hindbrain.
That helps? I asked with sudden eagerness. It really irked me when I knew something and had no idea where it came from. He laughed.
Sometimes. Sometimes I just get tired enough not to care. You staying here?
I am feeling extremely mellow, I told him. He'd run things off better if I wasn't with him. I'll stay here. But you better put a shirt on or your gorgeous self will cause an accident if you go running by the road and someone sees you. He smiled at that. I think he thought I was joking. I'll take a shower and read until you get back. By then we might think about food, making some or hunting some down. He hesitated. Adam, I said, we are out in the middle of nowhere. No one who hates me knows where we are unless you borrowed this rig from Marsilia. Go run. I'll be here for you when you get back. That's a promise. He gave me one of his assessing looks, then left, closing the trailer door gently behind him. The shower in the trailer wasn't horrible. I'd expected something only pygmies would be able to use, but it wasn't bad. I had no intention of using it, though, not with the camp showers available. Camp showers should be primitive. I've used camp showers that only had cold water, that had no shower curtains, and some that I came out of feeling dirtier than I had when I went in. The camp showers here were an entirely different thing. The whole building was air-conditioned down to a civilized and chilly contrast to the outdoor temperature. The floors were slate tile. The mirrors and the lavatories had hand-carved wooden frames. The countertop was a slab of dark green marble that contrasted beautifully with the bronze faucets. There were four shower rooms in which the slate tile and bronze fixture theme was continued. I'd never seen such a place in a campground, or even in a hotel. The water pouring out of the giant-sized ceiling-mounted shower heads was hot and sluiced the sweat out of my hair and worry for Adam off my shoulders. I stayed in the stall for a long time, and the water never changed temperature. When I was wrinkled and relaxed, I dressed in cutoffs and a T-shirt that had a picture of a ratty little house on it. The caption said, "Thieves welcome. Please don't feed the werewolves." Jesse had it made for me. On the way back to the trailer, the sun baked the water out of my wet hair. I ducked in the trailer, pulled my book out of my suitcase, and went back outside to lie in the grass and read until Adam got back. He'd been running for a long time. I read for about 15 minutes. Then the sound of something scuffing the ground jerked me out of the story. I looked up, but there was nothing but birds and insects within my sight. I looked back down at the page I'd stopped on, and I heard it again. It sounded as if someone was rubbing the bottom of soft-soled shoes on pavement about 10 feet in front of me, but there was no one on the road. I took a deep breath, testing for scent. My hearing is good, but my nose is better. I expected to scent a mole or ground squirrel, something that could be making noise out of sight. Instead, the air carried the old-fashioned tan leather, campfire smoke, a whiff of tobacco, and the unmistakable smell of an unfamiliar man. I set the book down and stood up. As I turned in a full circle, seeing nothing, the hair on the back of my neck began to shiver in a familiar way. I am a walker. That means, basically, that I can shift into a coyote whenever I want to. It gives me sharper ears and nose than the rest of the human population. It gives me an edge of speed, and I can sense ghosts that other people can't. There was a ghost here. I couldn't see it, but I could feel it and smell it. The scuffing sound started up again, and with the sun high in the sky, I walked over to the asphalt road where the sound seemed to originate. A hawk cried out, though the sky was clear of any predatory birds. I wasn't the only one who heard it, because all the bird song that had been keeping me company while I read ceased. Maybe it was a real hawk, but my instincts were convinced it wasn't, though most of the ghosts I've seen have all been human. The scuffs were rhythmic now, almost like a very slow polka. Scuff, scuff, pause,
scuff, scuff, paws. The scent grew stronger, and I could pick out one more. Coyote. I must have stood there for 3 or 4 minutes as the sound of dancing grew more solid before I saw him. I saw his leathers first. The rest of him was shadowy and dreamlike. But the fringe and the quill patterns on his sleeves and the outsides of his leggings were clean and distinct. The leathers weren't the kind you see at powwows. Those are well-tended, best-dressed kinds of costumes, mostly. Beautiful, brilliantly colored, handcrafted clothing brought out for special occasions. These leathers looked as though he'd worn them long enough that they fit him like a second skin. Thin patches were rubbed on the insides of his legs, as if he'd ridden on horseback a lot. The hide was darker under his arms and in the small of his back, where sweat from his dance would have gathered. He wore a porcupine quill-worked belt from which a coyote tail swung freely at his hip. The colors on the quill-work were faded, and the coyote tail was a little ragged. I started to hear the music he danced to. No mystical drummers or flute players. He was a musician, accompanying himself with his own song, a nasal, wordless tune that resonated in my bones. About the same time, I could see his hands. They were a working man's hands, rancher's hands, calloused and scarred. A man's hands, but not an old man. One finger had been broken and reset crooked. His hair hung in 2 thick braids that were finished with a red leather tie and stopped just below his shoulder blades. I recognized some of the dancing moves from the 2 or 3 powwows I'd attended in college when I was still trying to hunt down my heritage. As he danced, he became more and more real to my eyes and to the rest of my senses, until at last, if it had not been that I'd seen him slowly materialize, I would have sworn he was a living person, though he kept his head turned from me so I just got glimpses of his features. The rhythm of his dance changed from furious to achingly slow and back. At all times, his weight was evenly distributed on the balls of his feet. This was a warrior's dance, full of power and magic and the promise of violence. The warrior was who he was, though, and the dancer's nature didn't stop it from being a joyous celebration. The ghost stopped dancing with his back to me, his whole body working to regain the oxygen he'd spent in his dance. I wondered how long ago he had performed his dance in the flesh, and why he'd done it here. "Hey," I said softly. There are ghosts that just repeat important moments of their lives. I was pretty sure that this was one of those, because self-aware ghosts who can act independently are rarer, and they tend to interact right off. This had all the hallmarks of a repeater. That dance, full of passion and emotion, had looked as though it had been done at a pivotal moment in someone's life. But my voice made his shoulders stiffen. Then he turned slowly toward me, until I stared into the face of a man I'd never met, whose face was as familiar as the one I looked at in my own mirror, even though I only had 1 black-and-white photograph of it from a newspaper report of his death. My father. I couldn't speak, couldn't breathe. It felt just like someone had belted me in the diaphragm so my lungs couldn't work. He stared at me, unsmiling. Slowly, almost ceremonially, he bowed his head to me. Then he slid into a coyote shape as easily, as quickly, as I can. The coyote appeared oddly more solid than the man had been. He looked at me with the same bold stare he'd had when he appeared human. Then, without warning, he bolted across the grounds and into the bushes 12 yards away. In the photograph, my father had been wearing the uniform of a rodeo cowboy. Jeans, long-sleeved western-cut shirt, and a cowboy hat. My mother, a teenager fighting free of strict parents, had met him in a rodeo when she was winning prize money barrel racing her best friend's horse when she was younger than Jesse. She hadn't had a chance to tell him she was pregnant before he'd been killed in a car accident. The name he'd given her was Joe Old Coyote. I'd never seen my father's ghost before. He hadn't come to me when I slunk out of Montana, fleeing the only home I had ever known. He hadn't come when I graduated from high school or college. Hadn't come when I'd fought for my life against fae and demons and all sorts of nasty creatures. He hadn't come to my wedding. I looked for footprints. I might feel pretty confident of my knowledge of werewolves, marginally comfortable with what I knew of vampires. The fae are another matter. And I knew that there were other things I knew nothing about, some of them unique, some of them just well hidden. I'd been certain what I'd seen was a ghost, until I had a moment to wonder how my father, who died hundreds of miles away in eastern Montana, would have gotten here. He'd turned into a coyote just like I could and run off into the bushes. Most ghosts don't need to run away. They just dissipate. But there were no tracks. And I know how to track. Not even in the soft dirt right in front of the bushes he'd run into. I had goose flesh on my arms, though it was still hot out.
"So you don't think it was a ghost?"
Adam asked, then took a big bite of his hot dog. The trailer had a stove and an oven, but there were both a fire pit and a grill next to our spot, and we decided to roast hot dogs for dinner in the pit. He'd run until dusk, stopped by and given me a sweaty kiss, then grabbed clean clothes and a towel before heading to the showers. By the time he came back, I had a fire going in the pit and the food ready to cook. There were camp chairs tied to the back of the trailer, but we sat on the ground next to each other anyway. If I didn't notice that we were cooking right next to the behemoth trailer and sitting on a manicured lawn, I could pretend we were really camping. This was like the good parts version of camping. I could get used to it. I answered, then swallowed so I could talk. I didn't say that exactly. My father is dead, after all. If it was my father, it was a ghost, but maybe it was something else. There are stories about the Indian supernatural population, but a lot of the old knowledge was lost when the government tried to assimilate the tribes into the Amer European culture. A good portion of what is known was made up on the spot. No one tells a tall tale like an Indian, and no one knows for certain anymore which are the really old stories and which were faked. Charles, Bran's half-Indian son, born sometime in the early 1800s, could have shed some light on the subject, but, to my intense frustration, he seldom talked about his Native American roots. Maybe I could have pushed him into it, but Charles was one of the very few people who really intimidated me. So even back when I was looking into that half of my family history, I'd never prodded him too hard, much as I'd have liked to.
"You think it might have been some local spirit imitating your father?" Adam asked.
He'd finished his hot dog and was in the middle of cooking another. He liked them burnt on the outside. I liked mine just shy of hot. I watched my hot dog warm and tried to pretend I could believe that. Maybe. Maybe there is something like a weird doppelganger who appears to other people, or a backward foreganger, a death's head who appears after a man dies instead of 3 days before. Adam tilted his head at me, then shook it.
"If you really thought it was some native critter, you'd be calling Charles."
Adam was right. If Charles thought I was really in trouble, he'd help however he could. He might be scary, but he was family. Sort of. Adam gave me a shrewd look.
"You just don't like the idea that your father visited you, and you don't know why."
And why Joe Old Coyote hadn't shown up sooner. "Damn it," I chided myself. I knew better than that. A ghost wasn't a person. It was just the leftovers. That ghost might be the ghost of my father, but he wasn't my father. He died before I was born, but I hadn't suffered. I'd been raised by Brian and Evelyn, my foster parents, and they had loved me. When they died, Bran and the rest of his pack had stepped in, and then my mother. I'd never been unloved, never mistreated. I was an adult. So why did the sight of a ghost who looked like my father make me feel so raw? "Okay," I said. "Yep, you're right. If he could visit any time, why didn't he? Why now, when I don't need him?" I'd rather have believed it wasn't my father. He put his arm around me.
"Maybe it was some sort of vision quest without the fasting part."
I shook my head. "Nope, I already did my vision quest." He pulled back so he could see my face.
"Really?"
I answered. The summer Charles taught me to fix cars. One day he just took me out into the forest. We fasted for 3 days, then he told me not to shift into a coyote and sent me off into the mountains.
What did you see? Adam asked. Or is that supposed to be a secret?
I snorted. Sacred, not secret, I think. Though the only person I'd ever told what I saw had been Charles. But mine was pretty weird. I asked Charles if I did it wrong, and he just gave me that look. I tried to freeze my face into an emotionless but somehow terrifying mask, and Adam grinned.
What did he say when you showed him that expression? He asked.
Only an idiot would make fun of Charles to his face. Adam knew me so well. He asked me if I'd eaten something that made me sick, I said, though he turned his head so I couldn't see his expression. I think he might have smiled. Adam laughed.
So, back to your vision.
Right, I said. So my vision was a little... Charles told me that there was no right or wrong way to have a vision. It just was. Then he told me about some guy who had a vision and found out he could talk to spirits. Elk Spirit came to him and told him he had to serve Elk Spirit, and to do that, he had to dress only in yellow. Or maybe that was blue. So this guy, he did that for a few years until Bear Spirit came and told him he'd been talking to Elk Spirit and decided that it should be Bear Spirit he listens to. So Bear Spirit told him to paint his face red and walk backward. When Charles's grandfather, the medicine man, met this man, he had been walking backward for years and years. Charles's grandfather heard the man's story and told him, "Just because you listen to spirits does not mean you must obey them." I'd almost forgotten that Charles had shared that story with me. It was a sign, I suspect, of how upset I'd been that I hadn't had the kind of vision quest I had expected, one with eagles and deer who guide me to enlightenment.
"What happened?" Adam asked.
"Your hot dog is on fire," I told him. He pulled the black thing out of the fire, tapped it on the ground, and it broke into pieces. He got another hot dog and stuck it on the campfire fork while I ate mine.
"Mercy, what happened to the guy who was walking around backward?"
"He washed his face and started walking forward. After about 5 steps, he tripped and broke his leg."
"You are making that up," said Adam, pulling his hot dog in for inspection.
It wasn't black, so he stuck it back in the fire. I lifted my hand. "Scout's honor, that's a story Charles told me. You ask him if he can't tell if I'm lying or not." That was sort of a put-down among werewolves. Only a very new werewolf wouldn't be able to sense truth from falsehood. Charles said that the man never did go back to walking backward, though.
"You have to be a boy to say Scout's honor," Adam told me.
"Nuh-uh. Girl Scout leader here." I pointed my thumb at my breastbone. "Sort of, when my mom couldn't do it. Anyway, you wanted to hear about my vision."
"Yes."
I opened my mouth to tell him a funny version, but what came out was different from what I'd intended. One moment, I was sitting alone in the middle of a forest. The next, I was walking in a different place. Everything was gray, almost like a black and white film, except there was no white or black, just odd shades of gray. There was no grass or trees, just endless mounds of sand. It felt empty. Like those post-apocalyptic horror films, you know? Empty, but scary, too. I could feel it now as I had then. The tightness in my chest that made it difficult to breathe. The way the hair on the back of my neck had stood up because I knew that there was evil lurking, watching. Adam pulled his hot dog out of the fire. But instead of eating it, he forced the blunt end of the fork into the ground so it stuck up like a bizarre garden ornament. Then he pulled me against him, and my tension eased so I could breathe normally again. "Sorry," I said. "I didn't expect it to bother me so much."
"You don't have to tell me."
"No," I said, "but I want to." It felt right. Charles had told me I'd know when it was time to share what had happened to me. Some people were required to tell their experience to every person they met, but most of us only shared with a few people. So, I was wandering through this desolate place. The only thing I could see besides sand were remnants of buildings. In the beginning, some of the buildings were modern, tall structures made of glass and steel. On those, the glass was cracked or broken, and the steel rusted nearly through. As I continued on, the ruins started to be older buildings, houses. I clearly recall seeing what was left of an old Victorian, tipped awkwardly on its side, as if it had been a giant dollhouse some child had kicked over. Then it was like something you'd see on a Western film set, but decades later. Blackened poles from adobe buildings half buried in the sand, hitching posts and broken boardwalks with dead weeds poking out. I'm the only living thing in the place. Eventually, there are only tent poles, and I am walking by them, crying, sobbing with snot dripping from my nose, the whole wretched business, though I don't know what I am grieving for.
How old were you? Adam asked.
That was after Brian died, I answered. Just after, I think. Just talking about what I'd seen rattled me, my jaw vibrating as if I were cold, though Adam was warm and solid against me. He was real, but somehow that long-ago vision was real, too. So, 14 or thereabouts. Telling Adam was almost like living through it again. The emotions had been real and powerful, maybe the most real thing about the whole vision. Finally, I came up to this car, an old Model T Ford buried up to its axles. It was so sad. I could feel its sorrow weighing down my heart, distracting me from whatever had caused me to cry in the first place. I put my hands on it, but there was no way to dig it out or fix it. I explained that to the car, as if it could understand what I was saying, because I felt as though it could. I told it I was sorry I couldn't do more. Then, under my fingers, it began to vibrate, shaking until I couldn't hold it anymore. I had to close my eyes against the sand it stirred up, and when I opened them, I was alone in a forest. I remembered how frightened I had been in the forest. My pulse picked up, and goosebumps covered my forearms. The forest should have been a relief from the dead grayness I'd been in. The forest had been my second home. But the forest of my vision had hidden watchers, dangerous watchers, who didn't approve of me. It was a dark forest. Although all the trees were conifers, they'd formed a thick canopy over the top of me, like in a rainforest. I could feel that I was watched, but no matter how hard I looked, I never saw them. My watchers followed me as I walked. Eventually, I started running, and I panicked like a rabbit. It seemed as though I ran for hours. Every time I slowed down, I could feel them closing in on me, so I didn't slow down. Remembered fear had me sweating, and the muscles on the back of my neck were tight. I never saw anything while I ran, never knew what was chasing me. I just knew I was the prey in this race. I knew absolutely that if they caught me, I was dead. I looked over my shoulder as I ran full tilt through the forest, and my foot caught a downed tree. I tumbled down a hill and landed at the foot of a lazy boy.
A what? Adam asked.
I told you it was weird. A lazy boy. One of those big recliners? This one had a big tag on it that said, Lazy Boy. It should have felt out of place in the forest, but instead, it was I who didn't belong.
The recliner had been orange and blue plaid, ugly.
At first all I saw was the chair. Then I could tell it was occupied by a tall, handsome Indian man who looked not at all impressed by me.
Funny, I could remember the color of the chair as if I'd just been staring at it, but I couldn't really remember the Indian man's face or what he was wearing. I don't think I noticed anything except his eyes.
I got to my feet. My jeans were torn, my shirt was ripped, and there was a long, painful scratch on my side. There were sticks in my hair. I felt as if I were someplace I didn't belong, somewhere no one wanted me. I raised my chin and met his gaze eye to eye, though I knew in my heart it was a stupid thing to do.
The panic had been gone, replaced by a hollow emptiness that felt like nothing could ever fill it. Adam's hand tightened on my shoulder.
As soon as I began the stare down, a fox, a lynx, and a bear came out of the woods. A huge bird that looked like a giant eagle dropped out of the sky, and they all stared at me, but I kept my eyes on the man in the chair.
It had been unexplainably horrible, knowing that I did not belong in that forest with the Indian man and the animals. I was an outsider, alone.
"Steady," murmured Adam.
The man finally said, Who are you who walks in my forest, half-breed? I could tell he didn't mean that he wanted to know my name. He wanted to know what I was. I couldn't explain it right. The essence of the person I was.
What did you tell him?
Adam asked. I told him that I was Coyote. I cleared my throat. He stood up and up. He was a lot taller than I was, as tall as the trees around us and somehow more real than they were. I know that's an odd visual picture, but it was just the way it was. Without dropping my gaze, he said, I am Coyote. He sounded pretty offended. I sucked in a breath. I probably should have given him my name. It wasn't the right answer, but it wouldn't have been the wrong one either. So I said, okay, you can be Coyote, but I am a Coyote. He considered my answer. Then he bent down to whisper in my ear. I felt stupid about this last.
What did he say?
He said, okay, you can be a Coyote too, but you're a silly little thing, and I am a silly old thing. And then I woke up.
Do you know what it meant? Adam asked.
I laughed and shook my head.
That's a lie,
he whispered, pulling me closer. It meant that I'm not Indian enough, I told him. I don't belong anywhere. He burned another hot dog while we sat together and watched the flames.
I think you're wrong, he told me finally. It didn't sound like Coyote was rejecting you.
He was talking about my Coyote half, I said. Adam smiled and rocked me a couple of times.
How confusing it must be to have a Coyote half, a human half, an Indian half, and a white half.
I snickered and felt better. It was seldom a good idea to take myself too seriously. All four halves are pretty happy about being married to you right now. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it meant that we should get matching lazy boys. Though I would pick better colors. If you don't pull that hot dog out pretty soon, you're going to go to bed hungry.
Mmm, he rumbled into my ear. I thought that being married meant that I never go to bed hungry.
We came back out after a while, stoked up the fire, and cooked the rest of the package of hot dogs. Chapter 4. The next day we left the trailer in the empty campground. Adam had been responsible for setting up the security after all, and drove back across the river, on past the oddly named town of the Dalles and the less oddly named town of Hood River, to Multnomah Falls. Someone once told me there is about a 10-mile stretch where the annual rainfall increases by an inch a mile. Truth or not far west of Hood River, the scrub is replaced by lots and lots of trees and other green stuff. A few miles farther on, the waterfalls begin. Multnomah is the most impressive, but there are dozens of waterfalls on Larch Mountain, and we spent most of the day hiking the trails that webbed the mountainside from one falls to another. Since it was a nice day in the middle of summer, there were a lot of other people doing the same thing. I didn't mind the company, and I didn't think Adam did either. It felt like we were a friendly party of strangers, drawn together by the extraordinary beauty of water dropping in white sheets from rocky cliffs. There was a sense of awe that connected us all, bringing us together. The ties were not as real as the pack bonds, but it felt like the beginnings of the same thing. It was magic, just a little of it, built of fair weather and joy. That feeling of belonging to something greater than myself was the gift Adam gave to me. My whole life I'd been an outsider. First a coyote raised in a pack of werewolves, then a supernatural outsider in my mother's mundane household. Finally, an outsider who had too many secrets to really have friends. I was good at appearing to fit in, so no one really took notice of me. Until Adam. With Adam beside me, I felt like I belonged, like he was my connection to the rest of the world. And because of him, I could be just one of these happy hikers who were out to enjoy themselves. I shook off the faint shadow that recalling my vision had left upon me. Indian or not, coyote or human, I wasn't alone anymore. Some of the trails were easy, even handicap accessible. Not too far from Multnomah, those all went away, and the fun started in earnest. The top of the mountain is a little more than 4,000 feet above the trailhead, and not much of that climb is gentle. I heard the crying before I saw them. Thinking someone was in trouble, I broke into a jog up the trail, and Adam ran behind me.
"Honey, I can't carry you."
The woman's voice was on the edge of tears. "I just can't. You have to be a big boy and help me, Robert." There followed a boy's voice, unintelligible to me and interspersed with sobs. Around a bend in the trail, we came upon two very upset people, a frazzled woman in her 40s, and a boy with a tear and dirt-streaked face.
"Hey," I said, "sounds pretty rough. What can we do to help?"
She started to refuse help, and then her eyes fell on Adam and lit up with avarice. I sympathized with her entirely, but was happier when I realized it was the strength of his back she was excited about and not his pretty face. Her son was not nearly as excited as his mother. Robert, his mother informed us, was 8, but he had Down syndrome and was as wary of strangers as most 2-year-olds. He wasn't happy about the idea of Adam hauling him down the mountain to the parking lot. While his mother tried to reason with him, Adam got down on one knee and looked the boy in the eye. He didn't say anything at all. But after almost a full minute, the boy nodded, and when Adam stood up, he climbed onto Adam's back without another protest. He still wasn't happy about it, but he knew who was in charge.
"Well," said Robert's mother, flabbergasted.
"Adam's good at giving orders," I told her truthfully, "even without saying anything." So Adam carried one very tired and cranky 8-year-old boy who had a sprained ankle down the trail, while the boy's even more tired mother thanked him all the way.
"I didn't know it would be so steep," the boy's mother said to me when Adam stretched his legs a little and got ahead of us.
I thought it was to stop her incessant thanks, but maybe I was being uncharitable. Robert was so tired of being in the car. Eugene is still a long way, and I thought it might be nice if he ran off some energy, then he would sleep the rest of the way. "I hope your young man doesn't hurt himself. Robert weighs almost 80 pounds.
"Don't worry," I assured her. "Adam was in the army. He can carry an 80-pound pack down the mountain. That's also why he knows the difference between a twisted ankle, a sprained ankle, and a break."
I wasn't going to tell her that he was a werewolf who could probably carry us all down if he could figure out a good way to make a manageable bundle of us. Adam was out to the public, but neither Robert nor his mother looked like people who could deal with werewolves at this point in their trip. The army part was true. They didn't need to know that his army life was back in the Vietnam era.
"Get his ankle x-rayed anyway," advised Adam, who'd had no trouble hearing us. "I'm not a doctor, and sprains can be tricky."
By the time we made it down to the parking lot, Robert had recovered except for an exaggerated limp. His mother had lost the desperate edge to her voice. She thanked us again, and Robert gave Adam a wet kiss on his cheek.
"My hero," I told Adam as they drove away. "You done here, or would you mind going back up again?"
To my intense pleasure, Adam and I hiked for another couple of hours, then ate in Hood River. I'd never spent so much time with him without interruption. Here, there was no other demand on either of us. I loved it. Loved watching the alertness fade and the strain of taking care of the pack, of me, of his daughter, of his business, just wash away from his face and his body. Usually, Adam looked like a man well into his 30s, though werewolves don't age at all. By the time we returned to the campground, he'd lost 10 years of care and looked not much older than his daughter. Laughter lit his face in a way that I'd never seen before. I had done this. Me. Okay, me and God's waterfalls and mountainside forest. Even though it had seemed I couldn't get through a day without throwing him in the middle of my hot water. Even though he'd had to fight vampires, demons, and waterlogged fae because of me. Even though he'd had to fight his own pack, I was good for Adam. I'd seen him ticked off, in pain, in sorrow. It was indescribably better to see him happy.
"What?"
he asked, finishing the second of his 9-ounce steaks, medium rare.
Why are you looking at me that way?
The trendy little restaurant that occupied the old Victorian intimidated me a little, not that I'd let anyone, including Adam, see it. I don't think I've ever seen anything except pus